the point I'm going to try to make is the very point that Bruce brought up, is that the Old Testament is far more sophisticated than I ever imagined it was. And so they, you know, we talked yesterday about, somebody said, you know, the New Testament came along and corrected the Old. I think the correcting was going on, if that's the right word, the adjusting, the looking at things, all through the history of God's people. Well, we'll begin so we can, with tape or whatever, can start. Again, I'd like to share two passages out of this book, The Feast of Life, which I understand is now sold out, but I still wanted to put these things up before us because they serve as a hermeneutical frame or interpretive kind of reference that I think that I would like to have us wrestle with this week. Again, from page 2. In certain respects, all times and all societies are alike, but there are also important differences between one time and another, and between one society and another. Some are times of patience and slow development, when the full impact of wrong, death-dealing decisions may be deferred. Social orders have considerable resilience. They can sustain much abuse, put up with the results of much evil for a while. But there are limits to that resilience. Things eventually come to judgment. The results of wrong choices can be no longer ignored. God is patient, but not forever. There must either be a major change to life or an overwhelming in death. That's the theme that I want to keep before us. First of all, there's great similarity between times and societies, but there's great differences, and also the fact that you can't, you know, there comes times in life when you've got to change, or there's the overwhelming by death. Then this warning that comes on page 62. What must be added, however, is the warning that the preoccupations of a given era are not going to exhaust the language or the substance of faith. That's your point. And that faith will always be far richer than the particular insights which are essential to any one age or cultural context. And I think that's very important for us. It's very, when we take the scriptures in our hands this way, we are being, I think, faithful to the scriptures, faithful to the Lutheran tradition, and on very dangerous ground. Because we have said we are going to make some judgments. And I think we can use Luther as an example in terms of some of the way that he said really pretty loosely to some portions of scripture. But he left them in. And he left them in with the sneaking suspicion maybe there was something he didn't understand. And I like to live with that sneaking suspicion that there's something here I don't understand. And so even those parts that I want to throw out, and all of us, by the way, throw out much of Scripture. We serve pork here at Holden and all kinds of things, right? And so everybody from the strictest literalist down to somebody who wants to understand nothing seriously in the Bible, picking and choosing. Last thing I want to share from this book is from the foreword by Philip Potter, because it stands in stark contrast in some ways to the theme of holy war. Our confession of Jesus Christ as the life of the world is also our affirmation of life. We affirm that God made the world, that life is God's gift, and that whatever destroys or diminishes life is defiance of God. But how dare we affirm and celebrate life in a world haunted by the specter of death in all its frightening forms? And I think that's kind of a good question for us. I think the first question that should come to, at least comes to my mind, is how in the world do you ever put holy and war together? Are they not mutually exclusive? I mean, that would be seemingly at least the conclusion that one might come to on the basis of the gospel. So I think the first thing that would be important for us to do is to examine, and we won't have time to do any of this, so this is all by way of suggestion this morning, is to refresh our minds about what holy means. Holy has, in one sense, nothing to do with whether it's sinful or sinless. It should, maybe, in the second place. But initially, whether something or someone is holy does not rest at all in anything inherent in that person or thing. It's very important that we understand that. Holy means that which has been set apart for God. God is holy in and of him or herself because God is holy other. And so whatever God sets apart for God's use, God's purpose, becomes holy. And that's, unless we've gotten that clear. Now, obviously, folks and things, that if things can be morally one way or the other, but at least folks who have been set apart for God, made holy, ought to grow toward some holiness, which we would define then as being somewhat like God and without sin or whatever. But the first case is that holy means to be set apart for God. If we don't understand that, then we may not understand anything, at least I may not, by the time we get done with all this anyway, but we'll certainly not if we don't get a hold of the concept of holiness. So, at this point, I would start out by pointing to the holiness code in Leviticus, beginning at the 19th chapter, going through the end of the book, and especially I would ask you to look at the end of chapter 27, and to get some flavor for what holiness means, what it means that something is set apart or dedicated to God, and how that stuff can be redeemed and all of that. But there are certain things that God claims for himself for which there is no redemption. You cannot bring it back to yourself. And that's very important to understand, that their understanding of when God commands them to do something, like when they go to take Jericho, for instance, and they're to take nothing because that's all to be dedicated to God. And that becomes then Achan's sin in chapter 8 of Joshua, because he took just a few trinkets, which all of which were to be dedicated to God. And unless we understand this holiness, we're going to have some difficulty. The next thing that we need to understand, I think, is the cosmology, the worldview that informs this early material, and indeed, to a lesser degree, all of the material that we're dealing with. There is an intimate relationship between the God and the nation for all of the people of the ancient world. We've got to get in our minds that there's more that going on than just some armies engaged in battle down here. It's as if any of you have ever been to a Shakespearean theater and seen the balconies and all that stuff they have, there's as if there's something going on in the stage down here and at the same time in the balconies. We could use the image here in Koinonia. There's the battle going on down here between the earthly armies, and then there's a battle between the cosmic force, the gods, up here. Now, we, again, in the interest of some time, we could go and look at these passages that I've outlined here from Exodus. And if we go back and look at Exodus 5, then Exodus 7, 3-5, one of the things that you'll discover there is that when God calls Moses, in essence to show Pharaoh who is God. Pharaoh himself claiming, of course, to be God in this tradition. And so God is going to say, I'm going to make a name for myself. I'm going to show these Egyptians who is God. Now, this is a parenthetical remark. It has always fascinated me that if it's true that the God and the nation belong together, and when the nation loses, the God loses, it strikes me as rather odd that God chose Israel, who lost more than she ever won. That should be the first clue about the cross. That should be one of the first clues about this God who always chooses the wrong folks. I think I saw Dan come in, and I can never remember the Indian tribe. Is it the Navajos, Dan?
White Mountain Apache.
White Mountain Apache. See, I told you I could never remember. Down in the Southwest, Dan says that in this little village down there, there is a white clapboard Midwestern Wisconsin Synod Lutheran Church. Why? Because when the White Mountain Apaches were conquered by the U.S. Army, their gods lost. And the first person that showed up representing the white man's God was a Wisconsin Synod missionary. So the tribe becomes Wisconsin Synod Lutherans. That's what you get for losing. You lost twice your ALC, but but this ident- and so it fascinates me that you have this identification with Israel, and God never deserts this nation, nor a segment at least of them deserts this God who allows them to lose. That's a parenthetical remark, but it's worth pondering, I think. All right, now, so when we get to Exodus 14, which is the story of the Red Sea, you read that carefully and you will see that Israel does nothing. Absolutely nothing. God does all the fighting. And God fights, of course, by various accounts, either using Moses' rod or the strong east wind or whatever, but divides the Red Sea. Israel goes through. When Pharaoh gets there, the sea closes, and this is celebrated in the Song of Miriam or the Song of Moses in Exodus 15, and you'll read that, and God gets the victory. God fights for us. That establishes the principle. Now, I'm going to jump down to Isaiah. In 2 Isaiah, we meet an important concept. In Isaiah 40 to 45, and or actually, you could even go through 54, but in that whole section of sometimes called 2 Isaiah, you meet two interesting concepts that are interwoven. It talks about Israel being created by God in the Exodus experience. But parallel with that, it also talks about God creating the world, bringing order out of chaos in both cases. Let's look, because maybe it'd be easiest to illustrate this. Look at chapter 41 of Isaiah, verses 1 to 4. This will seem a long way from holy war, but it'll begin to tie together some things. And it also, these two passages have another similarity that I'm going to use in another context. You have here a tying in of the creation and of God's use of human agencies. In this case, it's an agency, as Bruce indicated, of God fighting against his people. But anyway, listen to me in silence, O coastlands. Let the peoples renew their strength. Let them approach. Let them speak. Let us together draw near for judgment. Who stirred up one from the east whom victory meets at every step? The Babylonians. Who stirred them up? God did. He gives up nations before him so that he tramples kings underfoot. He makes them like dust with his sword, like driven stubble with his bow. He pursues them and passes on safely by paths his feet have not trod. Who has performed and done this, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, the first, and with the last, I am He. Now, again, I hate to be so sketchy about this, but if you read this block of material in beginning in Isaiah 40, the connection is between God who created a nation in the Exodus experience, and then God who creates the world out of nothing, out of chaos. For the ancient world, and this is part of the holy war concept, what God wars against are the forces of chaos. God is the God who brings stability and order to the world. See, the Hebrews move from redemption, Exodus experience, to creation, not the other way around. They wrote the Exodus material before they wrote the creation material. And God was at war in both cases. First of all, bringing order to their life as a nation, and then order to the world. That's the way that's how they got into that understanding. All right, if you look at Isaiah 45, in which God again uses this agent, actually in 41 it's the Persians who he is bringing against the Babylonians. And here we meet it specifically in the person of Cyrus of Persia. And you can read the you know, the first part of that chapter. But if you get down then to like verse 7, I create light and I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I am the Lord who do all these things. And then woe to him who strives with his master, and so on. The creation motifs together with the warring motifs. That's what I want you to see. God is the God who is at war against the forces of chaos. So he brings order. Now, later on, we get God warring in terms of good and evil. But it rests on the pattern of chaos and creation. Now, to jump one more time, and again I apologize for this, to get into the specifics of the holy war. If what is in the background, and that's what I've been trying to say at this point, up to this point, is that God brings order out of chaos, God fights for them, God does this. That's the first understanding. Now, when God is, when they understand that he is bringing them into this land and he's going to fight for them, that's, you have to keep that in mind. God is fighting for them even in the holy wars. Now, they may be justifying what they did and everything else, but let's take their understandings for this. So look at Deuteronomy chapter 7. We'll look at 7 and then briefly at 20. Chapter 7, verse 1 and following. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, God will fight for us. So that's the major premise of this material. Then skipping down to verse 2. And notice that they are mightier than you are. That theme comes out over and over again. They couldn't get this victory without God's help. Then you must utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not make marriages with them, taking your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they will turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he will destroy you quickly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and hew down their ashram and burn their graven images with fire. Then skipping down to verse 16. And you shall destroy all the peoples that the Lord your God will give over to you. Your eye shall not pity them, neither shall you serve their gods, for you that would be a snare for you. All right, now skip over to chapter 20. Some of this stuff you wished were not in the Bible. That's the problem with it all, right? It would be nice if at least the Bible were neat instead of being kind of almost as complicated or more so than life itself, right? Here comes the directions now for holy war. Another set of directions for holy war, I might add. And we'll see this in terms of one of the first problems, or at least dealing with the textual material. When you go forth to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Again, that theme, God will fight for you. And then verse 4, for the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you that victory, or to give you the victory. And so then the rules go to that. And then if you pick up in verse 10, when you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if its answer to you is peace and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. That's a qualification, is it not? Then if we were to read through the text, we would find that there are qualifications if you had the good fortune, and Israel was on a roll, to be a long ways away from them, at least the women and children could escape the sword. But if you were a real close neighbor, everybody's supposed to get it. So there's qualifications to this, to the holy war stuff already in this material. Now, here's a textual problem, consideration maybe. Who were the hewers of stone and drawers of water in Jerusalem? The Jebusites. And so if you go and read when David took Jerusalem, you'll find out probably why this qualification gets at least lifted up. Because David didn't kill the Jebusites who were the folks who were in Jerusalem. He forced them into forced labor. So without this little qualification, whether it was there before David or after David or whatever, and that's one of the problems you got to deal with in Deuteronomy, because it comes considerably after David's time. Are they justifying what David did, or did David justify what he did? I just, again, want to raise that little question for you. There may be more historical conditioning to these texts than some people are willing or would want to allow, because it does start to relativize all of this stuff, and you're in trouble. I think it's trouble we have to assume to be responsible with the Word. Then this little qualification too, which I kind of love, it may be justification for neutron bombs. Verse 19 and following. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them, for you may eat of them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field men that they should be besieged by you? Kill all the men, but leave the fruit-bearing trees. Because it takes a long time to grow a tree, and so if you're going to get food from it, leave it alone. They put a holy war sanction on it. Interesting story, right? At least I find it that. All right, in order so we can have some discussion. We've talked a little bit about Joshua 6 and 8. And they just are, that's the whole siege of Jericho, and the destruction of Jericho is an example of holy war. God fights for them. They don't lift a hand. Everything in the city is to be dedicated to God. Rahab is the exception because of her allowing the spies to stay there. Achan takes these things. They lose the battle out at Ai, and they go through the process of finding out what happens. It's a reminder about what they ought to do. Then, as you move through Joshua, you get into an interesting discussion, because at the end of Joshua 11, it says that Joshua is old and he's done everything God told him to do, seemingly wiped out all of the folks he was supposed to wipe out. But then chapter 13 begins, and they start out with the same kind of little speech about you are old. But then it says there is yet much territory to be conquered. So how, you know, did they do what they were told? Were they obedient or not? That's a very open question as you read the traditions in the material. Now, if God fights for us, and God is a God of good or justice or righteousness, what happens when we are bad, when we are unjust and unrighteous? And here's where the prophets come in, and this is again the point that Bruce made that I really wanted to lay on right now, is that they came, as the title of this little study this morning is, that God will fight for us, or God fights for us and against us. Let's look at look at the passages in Isaiah. Look at Isaiah 5. And verse 26 to the end of the chapter. He will raise a signal for a nation afar off, and whistle for it from the ends of the earth, like you were calling your dog home for dinner. And lo, swiftly, speedily it comes. Who is this nation?
Assyria.
Probably the most hated of all of the nations of antiquity, because they were the most ruthless. they were probably the Nazis or the commies of their day. And Isaiah makes this bold statement. God is whistling them in for judgment against his own folks. That's pretty treasonous stuff. We can move to chapter 10, verse 5. In case we missed the point about who this dog is that's coming, that God has whistled in. Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury. I used to go around teaching to show you how much you should, how you probably shouldn't take too much of this very seriously. I used to teach, you know, this about how radical Isaiah 45 was, and then I started reading my Bible and found out that wasn't such new stuff after all, because they'd been making these claims about God using other nations and folks a long time. And so here's a case again. Assyria is God's agent for judgment. And remember, they hated Assyria with a passion. Because when Assyria conquered a nation, they decimated the population. Utterly decimated the population. They were ruthless, treacherous people. Isaiah claims God uses them. All right. And we've looked a little bit at those two passages, again affirming that God uses the Persians, in this case, the Iranians, to make a little historical irony up to date. Moving then to Jeremiah. Jeremiah we're going to look at later in the week. Jeremiah is called for treason time and again because he tells the people, Babylon is God's agent. So let's look at chapter 25. It's the easiest one to get a hold of. And you can also look in chapter 4 of Jeremiah and see this. Somebody mentioned that passage that Bruce mentioned comes out of Jeremiah 4 about the lion and coming to get him. And if you read Jeremiah carefully, sometimes he identifies this lion from the north, this boiling pot that's being poured out from the north, as Babylon, and other times it's God himself. God will fight for us. God will fight against us. Now looking in chapter 25, beginning in verse 8, and the first seven verses just kind of outline what, and get ready for this statement. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, you have not obeyed my words. Behold, I will send for all the tribes of the north, says the Lord, for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, Abed. How about that? And I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants, and against all these nations round about. I will utterly destroy them and make them a horror and an everlasting reproach. And then so on, he'll banish mirth and so on and so forth. God uses Babylon to fight against his own people. Now, another interesting, the Bible has interesting conversations with itself. And I want to show you one more. I want to show you one more thing, and then let's just visit, even with all of this just loose ends around. Habakkuk. Turn to the book of Habakkuk. God uses godless nations to bring judgment, to war against his own people. Habakkuk, whose name means vegetable. I find that rather interesting. He sees the same activity of God waging holy war against his people. And so he says, the oracle of God, which Habakkuk the prophet saw, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and thou wilt not hear, or cry to thee violence, and thou wilt not save? Why dost thou make me see wrongs and look upon trouble? Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention arise, so the law is slacked and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, Now here's what you want to be astounded about. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. He's telling us now to the Israelites, now I'm going to tell you something you won't believe if I tell it to you. A modern contemporary analogy would be, I'm going to tell you Americans this. Lo, I am rousing the communists. That would be the only equivalent you could get into this. Be they Russian or Chinese or whatever, doesn't matter, but the Chaldeans in this case, these folks, that bitter and hasty nation who marched through the breadth of the earth to seize habitations not their own. Dread and terrible are they, and their justice and dignity proceed from them. Their horses are swifter than leopards. They got bigger rockets. More fierce than the evening wolves, their horsemen press proudly on. Yet their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence. Terror of them goes before them. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and of rulers they make sport. They laugh at every fortress, for they heap up earth and take it. They go, and then they sweep by like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own might is their God. Mm-hmm. Guilty men whose own might is their God. Now, Habakkuk says, so you want to use these nations. But where is the justice in using a nation less righteous than us to give us the business? That's the issue now that comes up. And verse 12, art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord, thou hast ordained them as a judgment. They are a judgment against us. And thou, O Rock, hast established them for chastisement. He says, I understand that you are using the Chaldeans to get us for our lack of justice and righteousness. I understand that. However, I got a problem with it. And here's the problem. Thou who art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on wrong, why dost thou look on faithless men, and art silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? Get that? Why do you allow that to happen? For thou makest men like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his seine, so he rejoices and exalts. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his seine, for by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly slaying nations forever? Where is the justice of this time when God fights against us using these unholy nations? Habakkuk never gets an answer. Okay, now that's what I'm trying to show in those last kind of things. God fights for us. God is the God of justice. When we do unjust things, when we're unrighteous, God comes for us. He uses agencies that don't even know his name, have no knowledge of him whatsoever. Sometimes they are worse than we ourselves are. What do you make of it all? That's where I kind of want to leave it. But I want to leave, we have about 10 minutes and I want to spend some time visiting. I also want to throw out something about holy wars today. We have, in the first remarks that we had, we talked about holy wars, and we referred to them almost exclusively in the Middle East, identifying them with the Muslims and the Jewish people. I think in April or March or whenever this year, that we got a very clear statement that we are in what we understand to be a holy war. The President of the United States, speaking before the National Association of Evangelicals, said that communists in the communist world resides the source of all evil. That is a declaration of holy war. It's been an undeclared war for quite some time. What then is the implication of that statement for us in the light of this biblical material? I'd like to have us, among other things, I'd like to have us at least wrestle with that question.
Maybe he means that whatever means necessary to overcome this evil, we will have to take upon ourselves. Because God has chosen us to do that.
Okay, how do you evaluate that statement? In the light of, you know, in the light of biblical material, what are the pluses and minuses of that?
Well, I also read that he said, in that same speech, he said, it's better for your children to die as Christians than to live under communism. And I totally reject it. I don't want my children to die.
Okay. All right, back here. And
at what point should we take the initiative?
Excuse me?
I would say, to what point should the United States take the initiative into that fact? Other than, you know, the supplying of world arms is one of our playing both ends against the middle. It's a real question in my mind.
Okay, all right. Here?
I'm still struggling with the Bible and how that's interpreted, because I'm wondering, you know, it comes down to the question, does God use violence to try and correct violence? And doesn't that simply perpetuate itself? And it reminds me of, like, because then we can put ourselves in a stance of saying that we are righteous somehow and using God because we're acting as a vehicle of God. And it's like, to me, it's like a parent that one of the children hits his brother, and so therefore the parent beats up the child. You know, that doesn't seem to have a lot of flow that will work, you know, to me. And so it seems like that's more kind of a deeper question, you know, than even is Reagan right in saying that we are acting on behalf of God using violent means.
Okay, would you see any suggestions in the Bible that want to call this tradition into question?
Well, I wish, like, I can use more like New Testament tradition, you know. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, God, in Christ, God acts as one who is utterly powerless. You know, God is on the side of the victim. God suffers and does not use violent means to try and overthrow the oppressors, you know. And so I see that in Christ. And I would like to know more about, it seems like there's got to be that in the Old Testament.
I would suggest, just throwing it out, the servant songs in Isaiah are corrective and, you know, are part of the biblical conversation. Mark, and then Wayne.
Well, I'm not going to pick up on that.
That's all right, dude. Just don't worry about it.
I think the frightening thing about Reagan saying that in communism is all evil, the flip of that then is therefore in America is all good. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to me, that really is frightening, because then we don't have to look at ourselves critically. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Wayne?
There's a whole body of prophetic material from Amos onward that talks about the futility of violence, including the futility of God's violence. And the prophets raise the question against God, Jeremiah in particular, I think it reaches the climax in Servant Song, but hundreds of years before that is there, the idea of the futility of violence is already in the Old Testament.
Yeah, we'll look at Jeremiah and Amos and Ezekiel and some of those and see where that all leads. The reason I want to get this stuff as contrasting as we can, so we have to deal with this. See, because I think the Bible deals with this, you know, and engages in lively conversation about this issue. And so when you say, well, I believe the Bible, which conversation are we picking up on?
Is God using communism or Russia to shape us up a bit? Because through the years, you know, I think this gentleman here said we should look at ourselves a little critically too. But sometimes maybe God is using us. Okay, shape up, you people. I'm going to needle you, or maybe all.
Okay, see, that's a thought that often doesn't occur to us. And but you see, I don't know why I feel I have to defend the Bible, but I do want to lift it up so we see that it, you know, the thing that scares me about Reagan's statement is, let's suppose that it is, this residual of all evil. And as Mark suggests, we aren't all righteous. And so what does that tell us about this God who demands justice and righteousness? My goodness, one day he may come for us.
Yeah, Russia didn't start building atomic weapons until we started. They did that in defense of themselves, not for any aggression purposes at the time. We should look at their side sometimes also.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what frightens me about the Reagan statement is that the danger of absolute crisis.
Okay, everybody hear that? The danger.
The danger of absolutizing. The Gandhi principle would be that in the nonviolent movement, we do very much as Jesus said. We perceive the enemy in terms of what is good and not what is evil. In other words, not all truth is deposited in capitalism, nor is all untruth deposited in the communist system. But both systems have within them certain elements of truth that can operate for the total good. And so the approach is not to destroy, but to seek after that which is redeemable. And so that we look at the communist philosophy or the capitalist philosophy or whatever the philosophy might be, the ideology might be, and we try to mine out, good term here at Holden, to get at the vein of the gold, you might say, where their treasure lies, in order that we might find that which is best in them, and they might find the best that is in us, so that when we come from a truth and they come from a truth, we might combine to move to a larger truth, instead of being in a competitive, you understand what I'm saying? That God would have us seek that which is good, and that when we retaliate and so on, it is not that God is being punitive. It is that we have lost the understanding that in the beginning it was good, and that we are good, and that we are called. When Jesus says, "I am the truth," or when it says in John, "God so loved the world," it doesn't say the church in the United States. It says the world, that all might come to the understanding of truth. So I think until we get into that sort of nonviolent mentality, we're in bad shape.
Okay, it's again time to stop, and I hope people have more to say. I do want to say a few last things. First of all, much of the material that I used this morning comes from a section of a paper that Tom Lee wrote. I want to underscore that. Tom Lee is the LCA campus pastor at the University of Montana in Missoula. And I think for a dollar, you can send a dollar to Tom Lee Campus Ministry, Missoula, Montana, and get a copy of his paper on war in the nuclear age and how helpful the biblical witness is. It's a good paper. Another thing that's available right here is an article in the supplementary volume of the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, and it's on war, comma, holy. It starts on page 942 and goes to 944. It's by Norman Gottwald. If you want, I'll talk to you about Norman Gottwald's approach. It's a hard article to read, but it's also a helpful article in terms of sorting through some of the issues of holy war.